Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had the taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone, thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Afasiana, are you on mute?
I'm sorry. Yes, I was. I was stuck on mute. I apologize. Welcome to Part Sinner, Part Saint. Good and evil are not black and white. We all have a mix of naughty and nice. Poetry allows us to explore our dark sides and find our way to the light. I celebrate people who, like the founder of this show, recognize if they are on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person. Share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. I'm Afasiana. And this show, Part Sinner, Part Saint, is part of Late Night Poets, which is a group on the website allpoetry.com. You don't have to be a part of the group to participate, but it's more fun if you are. You can follow along in the chat, reading the poems as we do. And it looks like I have two callers. Now, one of them, I believe, is Pam. Pam, welcome.
Yes. That would be me. I would have to say to you, bravo. Being told I was on mute during my intro of one of my shows would completely throw me off. but you just kept moving along. Like, I mean, you were so graceful. That was awesome.
Well, thank you for being here to point out to me that I couldn't be here. That could have been bad. An hour of show of me not talking.
I think somebody was poking up eventually.
And I believe we have Victoria. Victoria?
Hello, hello.
Thank you both for being here. How are you tonight, Victoria?
I'm good. I'm really excited to be here. How are you?
Great. Just had a mini Halloween party with Rima and Beast and Casey and Frank in another little group. So I'm in the Halloween spirit.
I love it.
And yeah, it's going to be a great weekend, I think. Our theme tonight is the seven deadly sins. And it's our part two of this. I had so many people enter the contest that I thought we're going to need to spread it out over 2 weeks. And we had half last week, and we have more this week, which is awesome. So what we did in these contests were the seven deadly sins were related to a monster, and then people had to talk about themselves as a monster or consider how a monster might represent that sin. We got some really fun writes last week, and I know that tonight's going to be no exception. It's going to have some more great ones. So thank you for being here. And we are going to start with Seven by Patty Mike. Now, Victoria, could you give that one a read?
I would love to. All right, this is Seven by Patty Mike. I'm proud to beg, too lazy to excel beyond my station. I'm horny and busy, instantly gratifying myself to work for true love. I want to totally overstuff my fat ass looking face. I covet my little piggy bank like the girl next door, cradled in my arms. I would pluck out the eyes of my personal Ned Flanders for his greener grass. I want the entire world. Pay for making me this way. End poem.
Great read. And Patty, Mike, I really like how you combined the different sins here. And I really like the Ned Flanders reference. I would pluck out the eyes of my personal Ned Flanders for his greener grass. That is such a great Simpsons reference. That totally made the poem for me. But I like this mix of using the different sins, and you got them all in there, so that was great. Ned Flanders, definitely my favorite line. Pam, what did you think?
I really like this. It's good to see Patty Mike. I haven't seen him or his writing for a while. I really like this all the way through, but especially the last couple of lines. I covet my little piggy bank like the girl next door cradled in my arms, and I would pluck out the eyes of my personal Ned Flanders for his greener grass. I thought that was just a clever and fun reference. And I like how within a few short lines he encaptures the personification of every one of the seven sins. And I find it really intriguing that in the title he spelled out seven rather than, you know, just you say it as a word. So I thought that was really interesting, and this is an excellent write.
I agree. And Victoria, you read it for us, but would you also like to comment?
I agree. I really like that this kind of represents each of the seven deadly sins, one line to each one. But in all of it, there's no repentance. There's no remorse. It's just this pride and unabashed, like they're not even shame in relation to this. And so we have each of these. We have the different ways in which we each possess these traits. And I think that's something that we often forget with the seven deadly sins, or at least the concept of it, is that in some way or another, we all have one of these sins or all of these sins within us. We have gluttony. We have lust. We have greed. We have pride. But we always dismiss it as, well, this is fine. I'm not that prideful. But the fact of the matter is that there is that pride. There is that lust and gluttony and greed and so on and so forth. And so I really like this because none of these lines are so out there, so extraordinary in that sin that you would sit there and say, oh, yeah, no, he's definitely got an issue there. There's no judgment. There's no condemnation in any of these lines. And yet, put together, you start to understand how they act in unison to cause that corruption that make them so very deadly. So I think that was really quite fantastic the way he did that, because again, it reminds us that each and every single one of us have these in us, and while they may not be condemning by themselves, as a whole, they will eat us up alive. Just really awesome.
You know, that's a really good point, that when you put them all together, even if we only have a small amount of each sin, it does add up. Pam, I'm going to put your poem up next. You can read it whenever you're ready.
All right. This is Medusa in the City, and it goes like this. Sweetie, I have a newsflash for you. There's no one in this overworked, overrun monstrosity of a city that's perfect. We all have our flaws. We all make our mistakes, and we all eventually feel the fangs of consequence sink deep into our ass cheek. The lazy bastard can't get help with moving. The slut has gonorrhea and three baby daddies. The glutton is suffering from a gut-wrenching case of gas. And as for me, I have snakes for hair and turn men to stone when they make eye contact. Did you know I used to be a fashion model? I was the it girl of the season, champagne, limousines, golden highs, and all the attention I craved. It was all at my fingertips. And the physical pleasures, there were two ways, three ways, four ways, and any damn way I wanted it. I knew how to play the game. I knew all the gossip that was passed around about me. A spoiled, egotistical brat. That's what they called me. But tell me, how is it my fault that the weak and the ugly give the beautiful everything they want? They also called me envious. But the thing with envy, it's a motivational tool of self-preservation that keeps you ahead of the competition. Well, as it turns out, in this high-stakes industry, there's not much demand for a gal with writhing snakes on her head and glowing red eyes. And as for that jealous bitch who caught me in bed with her husband, I guess I should be thankful that she let me keep my tight ass and perky tits. Because it turns out men don't care if you can turn them to stone, as long as you erect their monument. End poem.
Whoa, that ending. That was awesome.
Thank you.
I felt like I needed, like, the symbols or something there. Like, yeah. that was a great line. love that ending. And, you know, there's a lot of depth to this. You know, you're playful in it, but it also kind of talks about the flaws in society, the flaws in ourselves, and you make a lot of great, you know, Greek mythology acknowledgments. But I really like how you talk about knew how to play the game, where you're like, it's not my fault that everybody gave me things. How is it my fault that the weak and the ugly give the beautiful everything they want? Because there is a lot of resentment towards, like, you know, the beautiful people who just naturally get everything. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I am one of those people who resent that, like, you know, pretty girls get all the free drinks and all the things. And like, famous people end up getting free stuff everywhere they go, and they're the ones who don't need it to be free. They can afford it.
Exactly.
So
yep.
You know, it makes me angry towards them. But it also, like, we should be angry at the people who are providing for them above anyone else. Not just them, because, it's the way that it's enabled. So I really liked how you pointed that out.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing it. It's really good. Victoria, what did you think?
So I think this is a really clever write. Like you said, there's that reference to Greek mythology. And I don't know if this was intentional, but it also plays on the original story of Medusa. Medusa was a priestess of Athena. According to some lore, she was raped. According to some other lore, she slept and broke her vow of celibacy with Poseidon, angering Athena, thus causing her to become Medusa. But along with that play, the idea of losing everything because you made one mistake, so to speak, sleeping with a married man in this case, there's also the seven deadly sins woven throughout here. We see the gluttony in her of wanting more, of continuing to say, what I have is not enough. We see the lust in her of wanting to be desirable and seeking that and sleeping with a married man. We see the envy of her looking at others and saying, well, I want that too, but it's okay. We see all these wonderful, we see the pride in her, you know. But either way, we see all the seven deadly sins and, again, how they created this monster. But the fact that it even played upon the original mythology, I think, is so very stunning because so often we look at Greek mythology as something old and ancient and non-applicable, and yet in this it does make it very real and modern. And throughout the entire thing, you wouldn't think necessarily of Medusa in the modern age, but you brought her in here, the idea of a model who lost everything because someone cursed her. The whole idea, even too, and I thought of this, but if you think of lust, and you think of what Medusa does and that whole phrase, where was it? What was your exact phrase? Give me a second. I'm trying to find it. I have snakes for hair and I turn men to stone when they make eye contact. I think what was really stunning about even that is there's a double entendre there. So yes, literally she does turn men to stone, but it also speaks to possibly sexuality of that look that you can give guys or, you know, people can give other people. And it immediately was like, oh yeah, no, I want to take you to bed. And so to me, there's even those plays throughout this entire piece that have those dual meanings, those little references, the innuendos that if you pause and think about them, it's like, yeah, I see where the sin is in that. And I think that's what makes it really genius. And I love Pam. I love Pam as a person. I love Pam as a poet. And so I can't help but look at this and just see the beautiful mind that really sits behind this to weave these words together in such an organic way, weaving this story that flows so beautifully. And yet in the end of all of it, you're kind of left sitting here going, wow, there's so much packed into this. And yet it just has this beautiful flow and completeness that makes it a fantastic, well-rounded piece. So I think this is like front page worthy. Has this been nominated for the front page? It's like front page worthy because I think this is just marvelous.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And yes, it was intentional to play on the original story, the version where she got caught with Poseidon and Athena, the goddess, got jealous. I wanted to bring the story into a more modern setting. So that was definitely very purposeful. So I'm glad you noticed that. Thank you so much.
Well, I have to say, you definitely did that marvelously. So, yeah, this is fantastic.
It is. And like Victoria said, it's amazing when you can bring like an ancient story into our modern times and keep the substance of the original, but make it work in a modern sense. I love that.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
It's too bad it's not in the contest because I can't give you trophies.
I think Pam does that intentionally. She'll write stuff for some of my contests, and then she doesn't enter it in the contest. And I'm like, it's because she knows I'd just give her gold every time. It'd just be like, take my money, Pam. Take it.
I'm happy just to write for the shows.
Well, I appreciate that. But I agree with Victoria that it should be on the front page. So we just all need to nominate Pam. And there we go. Now, this is a poem by Robert Pilecki. That's called Halloween Night in the Forest. Act 1. Lost in the woods on Halloween night, after a happy party with friends, walking back home late through the patch of a dark forest. The night was inky, pitch black. Blood-red moon pinpricked through the thick foliage, hanged between trees, limply flickered like a constipated beam of hopelessness, the cheerless comfort of a dying candle flame. Clumpy combs of wet moss dangled from the gloomy scrubs like the poltergeist entrails, twigs crunched under my feet on the moss-veiled trail. Something jumped ahead on the ground, right on top of my foot. Slimy black toads littered the path, almost stepped on one, and nervously bit my tongue. Vampiric taste of own blood was nauseating and vomit-inducing. Felt like infected with alien toad pox. Enormous metallic vampire spiders clutched their steel snare strings across the trail. Webs shimmered like a meshed steel dipped in silver, waiting to feast on the bloated bodies, slurp on the hot blood. Strange creatures prowled under thigh-thick creepers. A pungent tang oozed from every sentient being. Saw some glowing simian eyes through the daggers of sharp moss, swaying in murky thickets. Seemed like evil trolls, ogres, vampires lurking in the dark, nightwalkers stalking their prey. Suddenly, spotted one approaching from the inky shadows, gleaming with cunning eyes, simmering with spate. Face was bestial, nicked and botched, skin as pale as winter's moon. Cast me lopsided grin and flexed his caveman's shoulders. His smirk showed broken teeth, shaped like broken stalagmites, carried a mace and a bludgeon in his monstrous hands. Flesh crept, veins froze over, the hair on my neck rose like the hackles of a dog. Couldn't move, just stood there, closed my eyes, silently screamed my lungs off. Waiting. End of Act 1. Oh, wow. This was so full of suspense. This really brought to life the scene. You could feel the atmosphere of it, the way that it looked, but also the way everything sounded and smelled and tasted. To taste your own blood because you bit your tongue nervously really adds the sense, the senses here, that it was like a gag-worthy kind of thing, having this blood in your mouth, but it made it feel like an alien's toad pox. Like, that really, it brings it to life. Where is it? There was a part about this. Smell. I lost it. But there's this one part where it's talking about the smells of things that really, really hit me. And that the moss on the ground is like poltergeist entrails. That is a really creative way of saying it. And I'm going on this haunted walk tomorrow night, where you go through the forest on the edge of this farm, and they have things set up, like spooky things in the woods. And because they can't have actors this year, the way the COVID rules are, you have an audio, so you listen to it. And if you're at the right pace, then at the certain times, the ghost tells you, like, what's that above you? And you look up and there's something in the tree and like the voice is in your ear. And I just know I'm going to be thinking about this poem as I'm out there. And I'm like, oh, it's the entrails as I walk through the forest. So thank you, Robert Pilecki. You're going to freak me out tomorrow night as I remember this poem. Pam, what did you think?
Oh, I really like this. And I have to say, I remember you mentioning last Halloween that walk
And I think that just sounds like great, creepy fun. What I like about this poem is he doesn't hold back. He's got the visceral imagery. You know, I mean, there's different sides to Halloween. There's the side that we introduce children to where it's more lighthearted and fun, and there's just that little bit of spookiness. And this is that, you know, like for adult-type Halloween where you really get into the fear and the nauseating imagery that just makes you cringe, and it's part of the thrill. And I really liked the second stanza with the line, limply flickered like a constipated beam of hopelessness. I would have never thought to use the word constipated with to describe, you know, the dark sky as a beam of constipated beam of hopelessness. I think it's just absolutely a very creative line. And again, I really like that he doesn't hold back. I really like suddenly spotted one approaching from the inky shadows, gleaming with cunning eyes, simmering with spate, face was bestial, knit and botched, skin is pale like the winter moon. This is all about those fears of things that go bump in the night, and provides just a really nice dark atmosphere, perfect for Halloween week.
That was a wonderful comment, Pam. Victoria, what were your thoughts?
So I think this is really quite stunning. First, the idea of Act One and ending at the end of Act One, not letting us know how this kind of ends. It's that cliffhanger that I think we hang on to. We don't know if this is just an imagination, someone overworking themselves in a spooky setting, or if there really is something nefarious going on here. But I think what really struck me right off the bat is the idea of the night was inky, pitch black, blood red moon pinpricked through the thick foliage, hanging between trees. I think what's really fantastic about that is it's almost intentional. I cross stitch. It's something I love and enjoy, and it's calming to me. But you have to be very intentional about where you put the pin. And so when those kind of phrases are used, it feels very intentional. And if you're walking through a forest and you see these pinpricks of blood red moon, it feels creepy. It feels like something has set the tone that's out of your control, and you've just wandered into their domain. And then they continue on providing all these ways in which the ambiance is darker and creepier. The things add on to it. The wet moss is suddenly this poltergeist entrails. We have the crunching of twigs beneath the feet, which could also be synonymous with the crunching of bones, the biting of the tongue, and the reminder even of spiders being vampiric, because we don't often think of spiders as vampiric, but when you understand how they eat their meals, they pierce them with fangs, inject them with venom that liquefies their innards, and then they drink them down. That reminder of not just the predatory nature of spiders, but even how they do this, it just really adds to that. And I even like the contrast of the web shimmering like silver, because historically vampires would be weary of silver. In fact, fun fact, if vampires were around today, and I'm not saying they are, and I'm not saying they aren't, you would not actually be able to tell if it was a vampire based on their reflection, because historically mirrors were actually lined with silver, which is why they did not have a reflection. But most mirrors nowadays are not made with silver, so they would have a reflection. So I even like that contrast of these vampiric spiders with something that they historically would be seen as weak to, because now they're something more than just a regular vampire. There's something that you've lost a tool to defend yourself from. And it just kind of continues on, that idea of this web and being stuck in this area and just not really knowing whose domain it is. You're just going to succumb to whatever their whim is. And we're left with that idea. this creature popping up in front of them. It could be a friend playing a prank. It could actually be something nefarious, but we don't quite know. But they've done such a marvelous job of setting this tone that really does enthrall you in it, wrap you up, and trap you, leaving you wondering what's next. It feels like a held breath, and I think it's stunning.
That was an amazing comment. I did not know that about the mirrors having silver in them before. That's really cool. I got to look into that because that has a lot of potential for stories and poems. And yeah, I need to delve back into vampires. You know, I had a phase when I was younger that I was really into vampires, but I really liked, especially like, I think Anne Rice, but that got me thinking about it now, the silver and the mirrors. Love it. Thank you, Victoria. It got me spinning off into different directions. And thank you to our poet, Robert, for getting us thinking, because it's wonderful when a poem can start discussion that, you know, gets us on tangents, and we're not tangenting because we're getting away from the poem, but because the poem has sparked something in us. I love when that happens. Thank you. I need to welcome someone else to the show, Kel Smiles. Hello, Kel.
Hello, Faith. Hi, Victoria. Pam?
Pam's here, too.
Yeah.
Hello.
Welcome. I'm glad that you could make it.
Me too. You know, kind of chancy.
Well, it's one of those weeks, you know. It seems like everything's kind of glitchy.
Yeah, it's been wet here, and the dogs do not like going out in the rain. So, yeah, it makes it rather complicated at times.
I bet. You know, it used to rain all the time when I lived in Waterloo and London and Ottawa, but now that I'm out west, it hardly ever rains. So when it does, I'm not at all prepared. Like, I don't even have an umbrella because it's like, it's the desert. So I never need it. But then, like, this week it has rained 3 days in a row, and I'm like, well, maybe I do need to invest in some rain things.
Well, Ohio has very unpredictable weather. So. You never know.
The weird thing is sometimes the sky looks perfectly blue here, but you feel the water, and I'm like, where is it even coming from?
Yeah.
It's so high up, you can't even see the clouds.
This is slightly off topic, but do you guys have a term for that when it's like a blue, sunny sky and it rains?
Sun showers, I think.
Okay. I've heard sun showers before. I also grew up in an area where you would say, oh, the devil's beating his wife. I don't know why, but completely off topic.
That's cool. I'll have to remember that.
Yeah, I'll think about that next time it happens. It seems to happen here a lot. And never for very long, but there'll be like, I always think a bird pooped on me or something, because I'm like, where? How is there water on me? Who's spitting on me? Kel, if you're ready, your poem's on the board.
Okay. I call this Suck You Into My Sin by Kel Smiles. Oh, yes, you see me. I knew you would. All men do. None can resist. My feminine wiles, not even you, especially since you are in my presence and have my attention. I don't need spells used to beguile. I can if I choose. I am voluptuous. My frame freely loose, which is enough, believe me, I know. You'll soon realize I only need you for a short while. Anything you require will not matter, only that you relieve my desire. And then release you to the demons of fiery hell. End poem.
Well done, Kel. Great read and write. I like the confidence that you have in this rite. It has kind of a sassiness to it of, you know, I don't really need you for very long, but I can have you if I want. I like when you say, I don't need spells used to beguile. I can if I choose. It's like, you know, I have magic, but my body's already great enough that I don't even need to use my magic. I can do whatever I like. Either way, I get you for as long as I want you, and then I'm going to let you go. It's really fitting, I think, for the succubus kind of mentality of I'm going to use you, and I really think that that's where the myths of the succubus come from, because of people who were used and tossed aside and whose kind of alluringness took people off their path. So that was a really good interpretation of the prompt. Victoria, what were your thoughts on the poem? Are you on mute? Oh, she's gone. Pam, are you with us?
I am, yes. I really like this. I have to say, first of all, you can tell that Kel had fun writing this and that she had fun reading it. It did have that sass to it. And, you know, to me, it's always just a great delight to step into a character, into a feminine voice that doesn't give a damn about what anybody thinks about her. I too like that part where you say, I don't need spells used to beguile. I can if I choose. I am voluptuous, my frame freely loose, which is enough. You know, she knows she can use her powers if she wants to, but she also knows that the beauty of her feminine form is more than enough. And I like how you touch upon how this is all about the idea of her using those men to relieve her own desire. And then once that desire has been relieved, once her need has been met, she releases them and then release you to the demons of fiery hell. There's a real darkness and finality and that touches upon how people who are caught up in lust and even gluttony really don't think about anyone else except for fulfilling their own needs. So excellent, right, Kellen? Very well done.
Thank you, Pam and Paige.
You know, I like that you use the word voluptuous. I love that word. And, you know, there's so much of, like, women trying to, like, shrink and be small and, like, you know, have, like, a smaller presence, not only body, but something about the way that you kind of acknowledge, I am voluptuous, my frame freely loose. It's like there's this wildness of, like, I am not going to be contained. You are not going to, you know, make me... Now, nothing against corsets because I actually quite like them. You are not going to corset me into this role. You know, I am free. I am proud of my body, and I will attract people if I choose to. I don't know, something about that. I really like the strength in it. And Victoria, are you back with us yet? No, I don't think she is. Okay. Well, we will move on for now, and then hopefully Victoria will get to read that later on. So I'm going to read one by Bida. Here we go. Okay. This is called The Seven Deadly Sins. Seven are sins that are deadly, culminate into the wicked tree. First deadly sin is fornication. Have judgment beyond imagination. Second deadly sin is unholiness, opposite the holiness. Third deadly sin is lasciviousness, which also is wickedness. Fourth deadly sin is covetousness. Contained in it is the darkness. Fifth deadly sin is the strife, which is like sharp knife. Sixth deadly sin is the division makes one to lose the vision. Seventh deadly sin is but the envy, synonymous is to the jealousy. End poem. So this gets into all the sins. It doesn't really pick a monster to go with it, because I guess the sins are monster enough themselves. It does have an excellent vocabulary. I wish that the Beta would put more of themselves into it, though. I like to hear a little bit more of, like, your personal experience with the sin rather than just the information about it. But I think excellent, excellent vocabulary. Pam, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I did like that she covered all the sins. And you know what I like is that she switched up the words for this. Like, instead of lust, she used fornication. You know, instead of, you know, like, she used lasciviousness, you know, covetousness instead of, like, envy. You know, the way she switched up the words and kind of, you know, gave us food for thought. I like that she says here, and I'm not 100% sure what sin this is supposed to represent. I still like it, where she says sixth deadly sin is the division, makes one to lose the vision. You know, I feel like within that stanza there is the whole idea that any sin, anything that divides humanity from loving one another and causes that rift, causes that division, it is something that we need to take a long, hard look at and say, you know, how can we change this? So I really feel like this is one of those kind of rights that come from the heart and ask, how can we as people change where society is going? So excellent right and very well done.
I think that's a great thought, Pam, wondering how we can change society. And, you know, be the change that you want to see is that, no, I don't know who said that first, but it's a famous quote. And I think that in recognizing our sins, our faults, that is how we can improve, and through improving ourselves can improve community. So I'm really glad that you said that. Kel, what were your thoughts?
Oh, I thought it was interesting. But, you know, it's just, I'm with Pam. She doesn't really say what the last ones are. But, you know, just, you know, she just basically brings them all together into one. And, yeah, it could possibly mean that we lose our sight into our humanity, you know, by following or not following, by advocating or whatever the sins. So it's just really, I love her wording. It's, the vocabulary is really awesome. And it's just a really well done poem.
Well said, Kel. Pam, I'm going to put up a poem by Daniel Deschino. Would you read that for us?
I would be happy to. This is Fiend Folio, Epilogue to Monster Manual, and it goes like this. I am a knight, or at least I was, as I am discovering there comes a time when you're not what you were. The sword that I carried, although brings fear to my enemies from what it has done, is sharp no more. And the armor that protected me, now just a child's Halloween costume, a mask to hide the weakness and scars. In the cleric's robe I now call protection as a lesser weight on my burden's back, for age withers body but years develop character. And in the class of the cleric I have graduated. And the power I now wield may be magic to some, but wisdom be an unknown weapon in the weak of mind.
and the ancient dragons whose treasure hoards obsessed my youth have lost their power. A simple sleep spell, and they stay calm with surrounded treasures. I let them be, and they me. Now the succubus and vampire, by unending foes, partners of greed and lust, as want and desire, I find the same. But the torment of weathered tears transforms the cloak I would wear, and the power of invisibility enhances with each passing day. So I just need not be the aggressor, and these hunters bother me not. And the ghosts that hide in the dark places I keep, they plagued my body with venomous pride and boiled it with angry wrath into a steam of spectral fog. For then I need not spell or sword. I just don't look them in the eye, and invisible again I become. Invisible to them, but clearer to self. For I have learned to reflect with memories, not mirrors. Envy bites with poisoned fangs, and age builds immunity as the eventuality of human folly equals us all. Age has allowed me to learn the spells of perseverance and wisdom, to conquer my enemies and be the knight in shining armor to my fairy tale princess, of whom power is my strength. But age has its enemies as well, and they are not swift to attack. They are not fierce or voracious, and they fight with the hunter's greatest weapon, patience. The enemies of age merely wait like a lion, waiting for the injured prey, while the other fiends in their folio of evil do their damage, and I become weak. Time remains undefeated, weathering mountains to sand, evaporating oceans to mist, and with a blink and a smile and change, a shining knight and enlightened monk to colorless gray ooze of weary and weathered lethargy. This enemy is immune to spells. This enemy will not fall to the sword. I must defeat this with the constitution of my own will. I have rolled the dice through the years of this adventure campaign we call life, and I was blessed with the foresight of having applied my luck many times to this much overlooked ability. Stagnation is death, and so I move, and my enemy must crawl back to its lair of patience and wait as I rise to fight another day. End poem.
Great read, Pam, and I can't believe how much I love this poem. I'm really grateful that Daniel wrote us a second one, because he had wrote Monster Manual last week, and then this, the epilogue to Monster Manual, kind of goes with a similar theme, but he delves into a different side of things. I really, really enjoyed this. I like that he talks about how the things that used to matter to you change, and he uses the metaphor of like the armor and the child's Halloween costume, where what used to make you feel such strength and confidence now feels inadequate to handle your life. I also really like the recognition of like the cleric, which is often a role that you play in games like Dungeons and Dragons, which he did mention last time that he was looking at that book for inspiration in the monsters, but to talk about it as that cloak changing, and even if he chose that side to put all of his points into, to think about wisdom as his priority, sometimes things still catch up to you. Where is it now? When he talks about the cloak that he wears becoming the power of invisibility, because people notice you less when you're older. Maybe you're not seen as a threat. Maybe you're not seen as desirable. But people don't notice you, and you start to feel invisible, and they leave you alone. And this can be beneficial in some ways, because, you know, you don't pick fights the same, and you don't have conflict. but it also can hurt your pride. I like that he did wordplay with hide, where rather than writing it H-I-D-E, he wrote it with the capital H and the Y, referencing Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I thought that that was a nice, clever reference. Just by changing the spelling right there, made it work. I like that age builds immunity as the eventuality of human folly equals us all. Eventually, we all will make mistakes. Eventually, we all will have our flaws, and age will catch up with all of us if we survive. So that's really something that levels the playing field. There may be, you know, a bigger range, like in your teens or 20s, there's like the star athletes and the geniuses and like and then there's when you feel average. But when you're elderly and your body is failing and your mind might be failing, you're pretty leveled out. Like there's it seems like age does level that playing field. I thought this was very clever, and the way that he talks about time being something that you can't fight, no matter what kind of strength you have, no spell, no sword, no will, nothing is going to stop it. And then again, he has the D&D reference where I have rolled the dice, you know, taking those chances. This is just very clever. I love it. Pam?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you say my name?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I have to agree. It is absolutely clever. I like that he wrote another one, the epilogue. And I like that he brings us familiar characters like the cleric and the knight. And that he has this kind of like extended metaphor for how monsters change as they get older, how there's more of that sense of patience. And I really like how this covers all of the deadly sins, but then reminds us that the greatest enemy, the one that we have to rise and fight for another day, is that the end of time, death, is the great equalizer, is waiting for us all. And this is really epic in its telling. And, I just really like how, you know, this is somebody who has learned that not every monster is fought with aggressiveness. So excellent write and very well done.
That's a really good point. Not every monster is fought with aggression. I love that. Well said. Kel, what did you think of Daniel's poem?
Well, I got to say, I agree with you and Pam both. This is a very epic poem. You know, just going from being the knight and moving on to, you know, fighting the dragon and, you know, and this is, everything is just absolutely fantastic. Now the succubus and vampires by unending foes, partners of greed and lust, as want and desire, I find the same. You know, it's just, it goes on to describe his person, not necessarily Daniel, but the person that he's talking about. But he gives it immense personality, which is really fantastic. And I really like the last bit, stagnation is death, and so I move, and my enemy must crawl back to its lair of patience and wait as I rise to fight another day. This is really a fantastic poem. And kudos to Mr. Daniel. And with that, I'm going to have to go. I've taken my medicine, and I am draining fast.
That's all right. Thank you so much for calling, and happy Halloween. Yeah.
You too. Love you guys.
You too. Have a good night.
You too, honey.
Victoria, were you able to read Daniel's poem?
I was reading it, and I haven't gotten to finish the whole thing as I was listening to Kels speak, but I do have some thoughts. What I find particularly fantastic and interesting about this is that there's a growth from a warrior, and I don't know what anybody else said, because unfortunately I only got to hear Kels' comment, which was fantastic, not unfortunate in the comment, but unfortunate that I didn't get hear Pam or yours, I'm assuming. But what I find fantastic about this is the growth from a warrior into a cleric and the way that those battles have kind of changed him, changed this character. The idea that he's grown a burden of the death and destruction that he brought with his sword and his armor and the fear that he took or created by taking all those various lives. He became something that they spoke about for battles. And there's a point of pride in that, but also an understanding that, and it kind of reminds me of the idea of often soldiers that become great, they start as just these people who want to survive and protect their kingdom, but eventually they become known as a killer. And it's not so much about protecting the kingdom as, I know you can kill people, and so you're going to do this. And so your perspective or your purpose really shifts from protection to killing. You become good at that, and it materially changes who you are, because after so long, you just have this bloodlust, if you will. But even that just sort of drains you, because I can think of the Hound, actually. From Game of Thrones, you know, a great warrior who eventually just wanted to be away from battle. And so instead now he's donned the cleric's robe, which is interesting because when you think of the intellect, and I'm thinking in D&D terms, but often if a warrior, they don't have a high intellect. But if you're going to play something like a wizard or a mage or a cleric, you have to have that high intelligence, high wisdom, high charisma, and constitution, which is not the same as someone who does the brute force. And so I think what's really interesting is that transition from that warrior into this cleric who now is not really interested in the battles. Really, he's interested in causing as little harm as possible, but an understanding that with power comes those that seek it, those that wish to kind of find you and take your power from you. And I even think of Dr. Sleep, where you have those almost vampiric like creatures who go off and find the soul, the power of people, and suck it out in hopes of taking it and gaining it and continuing their life at the expense of yours. But instead of him becoming greater and more powerful, he's maintained his power. He had enough, and now he just kind of is seeking to stay alive just enough, stay powerful just enough so that that he can keep on going. But there's still that understanding that if he stops, if he doesn't move in some sort of way, that death will come and find him, that because of what the lot he's chosen, there's going to be those creatures that will seek him until he finally dies. So he is forced to continue on in that battle, at least to some degree. And there's almost a tiredness and a sadness in this because it really does speak of someone who went from greed and desire and envy into someone who now understands that the cost of those actions are sometimes greater than the reward that he's received. So I think this is actually really interesting because there's almost a redemption story in it. So just been really awesome, right? And really quickly, too, I noticed the reference to hide and the ghosts that hide in the dark places I keep. They plagued my blood with venomous pride and boiled it with angry wrath in the steam of spectral fog. I do wonder if that is a reference to Mr. Jekyll, or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in the idea of the blood being poisoned, that rage bringing about that Mr. Hyde, that monster, and the way in which even as we try and be better, we're still burdened with those inner demons that are just waiting for the right moment to take control. So I thought that was a really interesting little insertion into the poem.
I thought the same thing. I definitely think that Hyde was intentional. I mean, like, it's not just that he spelt it differently, he capitalized it. So I would agree that that's a strong point. I really loved all the stuff that you were saying from the D&D perspective. I haven't played in 2 years, but, you know, you remind me about how much of an intellectual and kind of, like, social aspect it has to it. It's not just, like, smash the orcs, even though that part's fun. There's an intelligence that it takes depending on which path you're taking. And I think that it works really nicely in kind of the microcosm metaphorical way that Daniel uses it in his writing. Wonderful, wonderful piece, and thank you for your comments. Victoria, would you read the one by Lady Galadriel?
Absolutely. All right. This is Enter the Dragon, Then Hide by Lady Galadriel. In the deep, dingy dungeon, you'll find my reckless need. A gigantic green dragon. We call ourselves greed. We answer to the sound of money or the sound of change. If you don't like green monsters, you will find it strange that we choose to retreat and hide more than you know. Where would you tell a dragon named Greed to go? I used to laugh and joke with the dragon called Lawyer until Huckleberry Finn introduced Tom Sawyer. Now I pretend that my name is Dr. Jekyll. Poor Greed Dragon looks to you quite fickle. Were you at the wedding of money and time? Greed and Dr. Jekyll attended in their prime. When they considered divorce, it was an earthquake. But the greed and pride wedding, there was no cake. End poem. Sorry, I stumbled over that.
No. Thank you, Victoria. That was good. And thank you, Lady Galadriel, for the poem. I like that it combines the dragon and Hyde. Because those were two of the options that we had in the prompts, where Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde were a reference to pride, and the dragon was greed. And greed is often related to pride. You have pride in what you own when it's talking about, being the lawyer. That's a profession where you make lots of money and you have power, and this, it could be something where, you know, when you have that, you get pride in your job. Not saying anything bad about lawyers in particular, but, like, you know, you have the pride, and then you want more and more, and it escalates into greed sometimes. Greed and pride can be really intertwined. So I think this is a very intelligent combination to put that dragon with Dr. Jekyll, and maybe to have Dr. Jekyll be the dragon, that have that dragon within him. I like that it's described as the wedding there, the greed and pride wedding. You know, there was no cake, but they considered divorce, and that was an earthquake. You can't separate them, even though it's not really a happy marriage of these two sins. But that is saying something right there. Pam, what were your thoughts?
Well, I really liked this one. I like how she opens up with, in a deep, dingy dungeon, you'll find my reckless need, a gigantic green dragon. We call ourselves greed. I like, instead of saying he calls himself, we call ourselves. As you said, there's that kind of connection between Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and the dragon. but it also kind of has that idea of it's a personal point of view. There's almost this idea of the poet connecting themselves to this. I also liked, I used to laugh and joke with the Dragon Call lawyer until Huckleberry Finn introduced Tom Sawyer. I really kind of felt like there was this introduction of this because Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn were both memorable characters, but there was quite a bit of difference in the lives they led, one being from an extremely poor family and the other one being a little more well-off, a little more almost innocent. So I thought that was a really great reference. And I did like the line, "Were you at the wedding of money and time?" Because when our sin is greed, when we want more money, the way we get that is by putting more effort into making money. And sometimes whatever you put more effort into, other things fall to the wayside. You know, love, family, friends, it all time, when, you know, your time is consumed, then, you know, you don't get to use it wisely and in a loving way. So just really a thoughtful write all the way through and very well done.
I agree. And Victoria, what did you think?
I think that this is a really interesting write in the sense of the kind of rhyming that they chose to use. And it kind of leads you along in this story. It reminds me almost like a dragon who wants to speak in riddles, but is telling this time more of a story where the moral is kind of shrouded in that idea of that riddle. And you have to kind of sit with it and pick through it to really try and glean the moral of the story. The idea that these sins come together, but even when they do, it's not truly out of love. Yeah, they're getting married by all means, but there's not a real celebration there. They aren't really there for the cake. They aren't really there for anything more than greed and pride, because you can think of those two as kind of going hand in hand. You have pride over all the wealth and all the things that you have, and greed allows you to accumulate that wealth. Allows you to kind of grow your collection. And I like that it was a dragon that was used for that, in this idea of greed and pride, because I think of like even Smaug, who's an easy dragon to remember for the wealth that they amounted. And even because of that wealth, because of that pride, being Smaug the Great and being able to reign in the Dwarves Mountain, to talk about Lord of the Rings, or really The Hobbit, he thought himself set, and yet in the end he was still defeated, even by his own making. And so I really quite enjoyed this. I noticed in their author's note that there's several deadly sins that they've woven into this, but even the hintings of like the lawyer meeting Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, and the idea of Dr. Jekyll, who had pride so great that he strove to become better, become stronger, become greater. You know, he used his own experiments upon himself and lost himself to them. I think there's really quite a bit of cunningness in that. So it creates this really fun story, but also leaves me wanting to sit here and pick it apart. And though it's so brief, I feel like it's so packed full of ideas and imagery that that one brief reading just does not do it justice. So it's a really quite interesting poem, but I really want to delve a little bit more into it.
I think that was great, and it definitely inspires me to delve into it again. I love hearing other people's comments on things because it makes me see bits that I may have missed, and now I want to go back and reread it and analyze it. And, you know, it really brings me back to my English major days in university, where I just, you know, would tear everything I read apart, but in like a good way. And sometimes still today, if I read a particular poem or a passage in a book, I want to write an essay about it. And I feel so inspired to be like, oh, I want to talk about what this did and this did and this did. I can't justify, you know, taking a week to write about something when nobody's going to read what I wrote. But still, it's in there. And when I listen to your comments, Victoria, it always makes me think that I should do that again. I should get into it where I'm like fully delving into someone's work, where I have time to think about it and analyze each little bit. So thank you for digging deep into the poems. This next poem that we're going to talk about isn't actually in this week's contest. It was in another contest I did that was not necessarily for the show, but I just really enjoyed it. It won gold in my other contest, and I had to feature it. I'm so sad that I can't make the audio work because of the way that he saved it. I can't do it, but I do recommend listening to his audio later because he is amazing in audio. This one is spoken word, which he's still really good at, but Pupil is an amazing rapper too. If you ever, if you're interested in rap at all, he writes amazing wordplay lyrics and his audios are fantastic. So anyway, I unfortunately do not have his rhythm, but I will read his poem, If the Cannibals Wore War Paint, by Pupil. Where tulips grope for the lens, we are the flesh-burnt pixel cowered in the lee, where the sum of bulbs capture the bee's pinstripe motive, then rapes the sky before her sun we leer, and bathe in the freon pneuma, where the trees infiltrate symmetry, concrete meadows choked by bramble, siphoning liquid air, the colors of nothing, and everything molested, before we rescue and tame their purpose. Destiny is decidedly by the dollar, the green thumb donated to the cotton and the flax. The cotton and the flax interpret the scripture, endlessly pitting men against godless heathens, where peace is inflated, so the woodland pirates pillage suburban geometry to panhandle for preservation, until an uninvited hurricanes with aliases collude with polar cap death threats and prank Atlantis, impersonating deconstructed purple nooses, binging but not watching, seeing but not foreseeing, nature at its most unsympathetic and ravenous. If the cannibals wore war paint, name it Earth. If Earth had a child, she fed it to the orphanage stoop, so ripe in abandon, a wicker of blue-green flame and blossom, swaddled in hubris, ready to be starlit exploited. Open your plastic eyes and upload this memory to the clouds, so high-res imagery may bless the blind with more than a billion sensational pixels and show the tulips what true color can achieve. End poem. I love Pupil's writing. He has such a creative way of making his images. He always has subtext where you have to read between the lines. You have to think about multiple meanings in almost everything that he says. Like when he's talking about the clouds, he writes it like it could be the cloud in the sky, but it's also the cloud as in where your information goes between your devices. Where is it? I can't find that. But when he says, bathe in the freon pneuma, I really enjoy that phrasing. And concrete meadows choked by bramble. I thought it was really wise when he said binging but not watching. I'm guilty of that, where I'll watch like an entire series because I can't sleep, and then I spend half the time like playing on my phone or daydreaming or like whatever, so like I'm binging it, but am I really paying attention the way that I should be? And then to see but not foresee, to see what's happening in the news, in the world around us, but not really think about the consequences and where it's headed. People reminds us to think about what's going on, to not just be there and be blind with our plastic eyes, and to see things for what they are. Like when he's talking about the tulips and how with more than a billion pixels we can show tulips how great they can look, because, you know, we have filters on our photos on Instagram and we change everything and we see everything through our cameras, through our phones, but maybe we should just look at it and recognize its beauty in its natural form. I mean, I feel like we could talk about this poem forever, because every line, whenever people write, has so much in it that you may not even realize at first. So thank you, people, for sharing this. And Victoria, would you like to comment?
I would love to. And I appreciate listening to your comment before giving my own, because I was really struck by where you said, the green thumb donated to the cotton and the flax. The cotton and the flax interpreted the scriptures endlessly, pitting men against godless heathens. And I was really struck by that because of the idea. So flax is actually pretty symbolic through multiple cultures, and cotton, both of them are used to create unity and purity and clothing. So they often symbolize that clothing, or as white as you could get before there was bleach and industrialization. And so I thought what was really quite stunning about that was that, you know, here you have this person, these people who are essentially being fed money to those who make it, the idea of perhaps corporate involvement into a religious setting, feeding these scriptures to kind of use against them. And as I was listening to your comment and getting to like peek over this more, what this poem really resonates with me is the amount of corruption. We've created this world in which we devour ourselves. We devour each other, men of our own kind. And we never quite get that none of this is actually creating unity. I have a friend who loves to be a warrior of her political beliefs, and she will take on anybody. And if they don't do what she wants, if they don't change their way of thinking, she will often cut them off at the core. She and I've learned to agree to disagree, on just various points, because I'm just never going to be as far into it as she is. But I also don't believe that yelling at people over the internet or face to face or in general, I don't think it ever really like convinces anybody to join your side. And yet here we are in this war with those battle cries. We have corporate involvement that pits people against each other through religious beliefs. We have these woodland pirates who are coming in to pillage the people that, you know, you have the forest people saying, you know, you should be more eco-friendly to suburbians, all the while suburbians like, but I'm not in the city. You have the at least in the United States, you have the school system where people are flustered and frustrated over Common Core math, but we're not sitting and trying to figure out how to fix these problems. We complain about them. We have the destruction of the earth in the sense of climate change, with the idea of uninvited hurricanes with aliases collude with polar cap death threats and prank Atlantis. So again, the idea of this world that is just under self-destruction, the polar caps melting, the violent storms coming from global climate change, and yet Atlantis here already sunk is just kind of snickering at this whole prank because, hey, I did it first. Now you're all joining me. Even the idea that Earth itself is starting to rebel against the inhabitants, because if we are its children, it is feeding us to the orphanage stoop. It's abandoning us and saying enough is enough as we tear down the forests. It speaks so deeply of destruction and on various fronts of destruction, that it's almost jarring the idea of these plastic eyes perhaps being the bottles that flood, the plastic bottles that flood the land and flood the oceans, as just these onlookers of you put me here, but no one's taking the time to clean up. And it reminds me of perhaps my biggest issue with politics in general, which is why I keep my own beliefs to myself, is because I can sit and I can talk about my beliefs all I want, but if all I ever do is talk and I do not act, if all everyone ever does is talk and they do not act, well, then it's all worthless, because no change will ever come from everybody complaining and everybody bickering and everybody pointing fingers and saying, well, if only they. It's just a distraction for us to not do our parts at being better in society, at being kinder to our fellow man, at being better stewards of the earth. It's all a distraction, and all the while this distraction has become this war of one side against the other, and yet no one actually does anything of worth. I mean, there's no change. There's no fix that is really being had. We just keep fighting and destroying each other until there's almost nothing left. And then what's going to happen? People will be too tired. So I think this is actually, like you said, a really intellectual piece that I can see these different meanings. I can see these different call-outs that really just kind of make you sit on it. In many ways, hope that there's a call to action, and yet it seems that we're all just going to keep villainizing everybody else because, hey, I can't be the bad guy because I don't think I'm bad. So really, really quite a thought-provoking piece.
That was a thought-provoking comment, so thank you very much for that, Victoria. And, you know, I think you and people would really get along, so I would check out more of his work. Pam, what did you think of People's Peace?
Well, first of all, I think you both made wonderful comments. And I really, I have to agree, I'm a big fan of People's work. It is intellectual. I love how he oftentimes has those double meanings within his lines. And, you know, I like that there is that statement here of a social message. What intrigued me was this line that was brought up, is where he said, destiny is decided by the dollar, the green thumb donated to the cotton and the flax. The cotton and the flax interpret the scripture endlessly, seeing man against godless heathens. And what that very much reminded me of is when Richard Wiseman did his Halloween show on Southern Gothic, and how there's that headbutting, that you know, tug of war between the old ways, the religion, and you know, and the how the idea of those who are often seen as what is supposed to be a representation of being good turn out not to be good, and the greed, you know, and the power hungry of this world. I also really liked how he did mention the memory to the clouds and the idea that when you put yourself out there online, it becomes unsafe. You just start to lose yourself. Also, the phrase Phreon Pneuma I thought was really wonderful, because, you know, with Pneuma being the Greek word for breath or spirit. Originally, it was meant to represent the spirit, and then Phreon being like a refrigerant. You know, it really gives the idea that when we turn our spirits away from what was it, as mankind was originally supposed to treat each other with love, with respect, with dignity, with equality, and we harden our hearts, we make ourselves cold. Society itself decays and freezes, and it just really just a powerful and thought-provoking write, and very well done.
I agree. I think that was a wonderful comment, Pam. Are you up for a read, Pam?
Absolutely.
Awesome. I put one up whenever you're ready.
This is Rose Ridden Rendezvous by Nizar Solomon, and it goes like this. Why creeps in me fears? Okay, I'm sorry. Just give me a moment. I was standing up because I was standing up because my tailbone was hurting sitting down. But my poor eyesight is too far away from this. So I am going to read it, but let me adjust myself so that I can actually see the print better. I do apologize.
Okay.
All right. And here we go. Why creeps in me fears when passing a man old in years, benched under streetlight, his blue shadow and dusty hue, arched heavy rusty years and wrinkled age dry tears, holding a dead rose strew or dangling from the tail dead shrew? Oh, never mind, never mind, I say, just a creepy old decay. Why I feel such dismay to merely a figure in the way? For years he is my view on my way to lover's queue. Under a goddess window we lay, serenading a love play. May one of the lucky few win her for a rendezvous. The night of nights she appeared as light, and all went ah and oh, hoping for her woo. I'll kneel in plights as lovers and knights, and the goddess threw a rose-ridden rendezvous, the rendezvous. Oh, the maiden of the land threw the rose into my hand, and I waved the rose in all view, and as I read, I flew. It said, meet me at the plain, the end of Lover's Lane, where the lonely old man Hugh is our rendezvous. In a flash I was there, and all the creep I stare, still silent and scary, my heart grew wary. How could my gentle maid not be so afraid of such an ugly view at our first rendezvous? Oh, never mind, oh, never mind, I say, merely seconds in the day, for nothing matters today but the stars of the play, and love is our dumbfound to all the world around. So I'll sit and wait till the time, till the day, growing closer and closer grew time to rendezvous the lily. Deep fear creeps within as the midnight hour crawling in dark silence, drowning hue as a candle floating the deep blue. Why I feel such a loss when I'm holding a blessed cross from goddess who loves me true with rose-scented rendezvous. Oh, never mind, never mind, I say, soon shall all pass away. I hear cracking of rusty ears as he moves till face appears. His jaw squeaked to a leer as darkness creeps near and near, and felt the flutters of the cross as gusty wind above me blow. Then he utters a dusty mist, roaring words with inky gist. In his spatting of the goo at my roses, ridden rendezvous, he said the buzzards only roam the stench of deathly dome. On the shoulders you carry forgotten gore and airy, and brains but rotting loam when there is no one home, and when flutter closely at rally is the death of your at your alley. For this rose you dearly daily is dally is the lily of the valley, angel heart. And mine no dangling shrew, but same ridden rendezvous, and you never came along, for you're here all along. If you look my eyes to see, and I did to see only me, and all the lovers are you, and I looked behind the view. Another me cue with rose-ridden rendezvous, at me, the me stare, as I did before at old man glare, muttering me in dismay with never mind creep in the way. Oh, I shivered in my fears as panic within me sears. I feel the clawing of the crows and the flesh in the raw, and the hover of deathly things, the flutter of the wings, and darkness comes me crate as the old man dissipates. And his fingers lost control, releasing the rose to roll, as I watched it with my eye. May it be just a lie, for it's only true if the rose-ridden rendezvous, total recall. And as the rose began to fall, I began to recall my life act by act till the end of the pact with the devil I made and with blood I paid, the price of the truth of everlasting youth, a lover of all with no loving at all. In a flash I pass upon fragile glass, shattered in eighth, lays in my wake. Is that why I'm here on a grim, deathly bier? Why I carry all the blame when all we are all the same, racing by scores, causing the sores? Is it really only me, or is it it's you that I see next in the queue with rose written on the blue carousel of the brawl? For we all look the same at the end of the game, dead vultures, dead beast, corpse, and vultures feast, and all feed on all in the carousel of the brawl. No winners at all, nor winnings to haul. Just climb to fall down, round and round, passing the gate from the light to the hate, in the darkest fate, the devil's gate, in the master's lure to the end of the tour, to the grim rue with rose-ridden rendezvous, the descent. The buzzards began to claw on the bone in the raw, my flesh began to drain with the tears of the pain and the spatting of the goo from the flutter spew and the gore in frenzy gush and soar. My corpse turned to foam, falling down in the loam. My soul remained in place, facing you next to the face, uttering your same fate as I began to dissipate. Same play and same show till my fingers let go. And that my rose fixed your eyes, may you prove it a lie. And I looked final time at old man rose downward climb, as final darkness upon me roll at the rose and the fall, laid among the dead strews of roses, written rendezvous. And the end of poem, end of rendezvous.
Wow. That was a long one, so thank you so much, Pam, for doing that marathon. You did a great job with it, and I think that you really showed the cadence of the poem. It seemed like this had a good rhythm to it, a good meter, because I could tell in the way that you were reading it exactly like how the syllables were flowing. So I think that it was written very nicely in terms of meter. And I loved the internal rhymes. So much internal rhyme here is really tricky to make it work this way when you're writing. And I think that it was done masterfully. Excellent form. Is it a villainette because it has the different sections to it? I can't remember the rules of a villainette. I'm not sure exactly what form it is, but it definitely has great meter, great rhyme, and it's broken down into little sections, but they all connect. So I think excellent structure. Victoria, what were your thoughts?
So what I really like about this is that it's almost kind of maddening. It's such a lengthy poem, and that's a good thing. So please, if he gets to listen, if they get to listen afterwards, this is not criticism. This is actually a very good thing because it's so long that, and you get so caught up in the current verse that, or act or part, that you almost start to lose the very beginning. And looking at their author's note, it is supposed to be based off of Angel Heart, which is an older movie that this detective is hired to find. I forget who he's supposed to find, but he's supposed to find someone. And as he goes along, like every person he questions ends up like brutally murdered. And there actually turns out to be like black arts and witchcraft in the back end that you find out as this kind of progresses. But it's really kind of maddening, this idea of trying to have these rendezvous and they never go quite as planned. Things happen, and it seems almost as if life at the end is kind of expected. But what I really appreciate about this is that even though there's length, and it's a fantastic story, but I'm definitely going to need to read it again to capture all of it. But each individual act, each individual part always has at least one sentence by itself. And quite a few of them are almost repetitive. The, oh, never mind, oh, never mind. Oh, never mind, I say, just a creepy old decay. Oh, never mind, I say, merely seconds in the day. Never mind, I say, soon this shall all pass away in his spatting of the goo at my rose-written rendezvous. Of this rose you dearly, dearly dally is the lily of the valley. And those individual lines almost in and of themselves create this kind of poem. And again, I haven't gotten a chance to go through and read all of it, so I want to go back and do that. But I feel like there's even kind of that layering with those individual stanzas that is talking about how the person is slowly losing themselves. They're trying to grasp the situation that they've been placed in each of these, and figure out what's really going on. And I like the repetition of this rose in regards to the rendezvous, because so often we think of roses as love, but actually depending on the color, they can mean a variety of different things. And I with that being said, it is almost classical that when a person dies, a single rose is placed upon their grave before they're buried. And so I too have to wonder if this is almost the madness of a ghost who is now looking back at this journey that brought them to their demise, and yet perhaps they don't know that they're dead. They just keep looking at this rose and trying to remember how it came into their life. And so that idea of it starting off the decay could be this ghost recognizing that they're dead, but not quite realizing it yet. And so they're going through the story of their demise until finally they're able to meet the end in that final fall, if you will, laid amongst the dead strews of rose written rendezvous. So again, laid against all these graveyards. Now I understand that this is where I rest. This is the rendezvous. This is my final place that I don't get to leave. It gives me goosebumps, but I think this is really, really quite stunning, and definitely, especially given the length, I think is so deserving of multiple read-throughs. It's a fantastic story. It truly is a fantastic story.
Wow. That comment was amazing, and I really, really like your interpretation of them being dead and not recognizing it and then coming to terms with it, with that rose. I did not clue into that until you said it, but now I can't see it any other way. So thank you so much for saying that. Pam, you read it and you made it through without sounding out of breath, which I think I would have been. what did you think?
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is epic, and it is wonderfully written, and I like what Victoria had to say, and I like how he separates each part, and they all have their differences, and yet, as was mentioned, there's those lines that connect them, the words that connect them, like the mention of the rose, the mention of the word rendezvous, and oh, never mind, never mind. I tell you, I don't know about you two, but whenever I do a long read like this, my worst concern is that my phone has hung up. Like, and I won't notice because I'm only focused on the poem. I can't see anybody saying, Pam, your phone is gone. We can't hear you. And so, yeah, and the out of breath thing. But I like how this has that impeccable, like that rhyme and flow that made it just a delight to read. I like how he separated each part. And it was interesting that each part that was, kind of like a vignette. So I wouldn't necessarily, I wouldn't refer to this as a vignette, but it's similar in the idea that, you know, the parts are all connected to the whole and yet stand separately on their own. And I like how each part is the title of a movie, it seems like, or at least many of them are. And, you know, I just... really a wonderful dark write and emotive write. And it really just focuses on how we fear to get old, and we fear to get old because it means, you know, it means that the chances of meeting death greatly increases. So just really, really a cool, epic write and very well done.
Yes, it really is. And thank you. That was a great comment. This next poem is by Eminem Fan 25, The Pride of Mr. Hyde. Like Dr. Jekyll, I am kind, and I put people first. But when I'm pushed beyond the brink, I have an evil thirst. Some people say conceitedness, but I must disagree. I call it pride of who I am and who I'm meant to be. Whenever I am deep in love and she wants to break up, I cannot simply cry at night until I've had enough. I use my words to cut them down in hopes they will fall and feel like they have failed in life until they start to bawl. I tell them that my words are read from all around the globe, and soon I will not have to work and change out of my robe. There is no benefit to pride, at least not said out loud. It sets my course to self-destruct, leaving a mushroom cloud. It's difficult to speak the words and easier to text. I'm just another soul on earth, no better than the next. End poem. Wow. Well, I really liked this. I thought it had a nice flow to it. I thought it had a self-reflective kind of rough honesty of, like, you know, trying to tear your ex-partner down and then realizing that you're just making things worse. This is a self-destruct thing to be bragging about how great you are. When you say it out loud, it doesn't make it good. And that fear of saying it out loud too, and just texting and taking that easy out when things aren't going well, and hiding behind the screen. I like this. I felt like I was expecting it to be kind of lyrical, because I believe Eminem Fan 25 usually writes in kind of a lyrical or sometimes rap kind of way, and I really wish that I had some audios from them, because I have the sense that their writing really should have a rhythm to it that I don't quite put my finger on, but that it could work that way. Pam, what did you think?
I really like this. I'm a fan of Eminem Fan's work. He does have a great lyrical quality of nice metered rhyme, and I have to agree with you. It would be nice to hear his voice, to hear him. I think that his own reading would capture his well. And I like how this touches on pride and how, you know, it becomes our own destruction. And I like the phrase, like, when I'm pushed beyond the brink, I have an evil thirst. And there is no no benefit to pride, at least not said out loud. It sets my course to self-destruct, leaving a mushroom cloud. I like how this all becomes very much about how we act differently, as you were mentioning, behind the screen, how when we text or we post that on Facebook. I know Victoria talked a little bit about this on people's people almost, like, I just post anything on Facebook very rarely, but you know, you see people confronting people, battling people, getting into being rude to each other, and you can't even imagine them with each other on the street. And I really like how this reminds us that we're only we butt heads. So excellent and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. Victoria, what were your thoughts?
So I'm probably interpreting this with a biased veil, given the events in my life as of late. I've spoken on my shows about how my sister's married to an abusive man, and she served him last week with divorce papers. And one of the things that he has said and has tried to use against her, along with a army chaplain, is that none of the abuse counts because he's never hit her. And that everybody else thinks that he's a great guy, except for those moments when he's not. And this poem really kind of reminds me of that. And I hadn't thought about it as a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type of thing, but something that's overwhelmingly apparent when you think of it in that light is that a toxic person, someone who's pride or someone who's angry or someone who's abusive and all those things, they never think of themselves as a bad person. They just think of themselves as a good person who just every once in a while has an issue, except that those issues are so severe that it does away with all the good. And we all have our own little tendencies where we're toxic and where we're bad and, frankly, where we're all abusive to some extent. It's part of growing and being better and doing better. Those that choose to be stagnant are the ones that tend to be the real problem children. But this piece, this poem reminds me of that. The entire time, it starts off with an excuse. You know, I like Dr. Jekyll, I am kind. I put people first. But when I'm pushed beyond the brink, I have an evil thirst. But he has to be pushed beyond the brink first. So it's fine because he's just not always pushed beyond the brink. Some people say conceitedness, but I must disagree. I call it pride of who I am and who I'm meant to be. Again, that idea of, well, everybody else just doesn't know me, and therefore it's okay. They just misunderstood me. I'm not actually that bad. Whenever I'm deep in love and she wants to break up, I cannot simply cry at night until I've had enough. I use my words to cut them down in hopes that they will fall and feel like they have failed in life until they start to bawl. Again, that idea that because she wanted to break up, they are the ones that must be hurt. It's about inflicting that pain because they're just, obviously this person has it wrong. So they need to know. It's hard for me to read, if I'm being fully honest, because I'm seeing this live action with my sister. And I don't think that Eminem Fam 25 is an abusive person. I think he's writing this in character, not as themselves. But this is hard to read because when you start picking it apart and you start really looking at the core of each of these, it sounds like the words of an abuser. And there's no excuse, and yet in every verse, every couple of verses, there's this idea of, you know, oh, I'm better than them. I'm doing all of this. But then, of course, there's that recall that all abusers do when they know that they've gone too far of backpedaling and pretending like it's okay. And, oh, well, I'm getting better now because I recognize that I'm no better than everybody else. The idea of striking out via text so you don't even have to see your victim's face. And I can even imagine the rereading of text over, just pleased with yourself at the devastation. This is really, really hard to read because it comes from such a dark place. And again, not implying that was their intent is to speak of their own dark place, but they've gone into the mind of this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde character so deeply that it's hard to read because it's this giant red flag. It's this massive amount of darkness, all excused as, you know, but it's never my fault. I don't need to do better. I figured it out in the end, so the next time doesn't matter. It's just wow. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm kind of rambling here, so I'll just wow.
You know what? I definitely see what you're saying. I felt that way during the stanza that starts with, I use my words to cut them down. When I read that stanza, I'm like, well, that is definitely an abusive attitude. You can see like the gaslighter in that where there's the plan for them to seem like the crazy ones. But like you said, it's the character the Mr. Hyde and Dr. Jekyll, not Eminem fan in this. But I definitely can see how that would be hard to read. I found at least that one stanza really struck me in that way. But I think it's also a testament to how good Eminem fan 25 is, because so in character that it is, you know, he makes it believable. It feels like triggering, for lack of a better word, because it's so real in that aggressive kind of narcissistic perspective of Dr. Jekyll, or Mr. Hyde, or the combination of the two. So I think it's good to bring up how hard that is, because it is from the perspective of the bad guy. And I mean, like, that is the theme, you know, it's about the sins and the monsters. So going from the bad guy perspective is the way to go for this contest, but definitely a dark, right? So thank you for sharing
absolutely.
That, Victoria.
And again, I think it's a marvelous right that he was able to capture that character. And again, I don't get the reflection on them personally, but it's, yeah, you're right. It is such a real capturing of that character that it's just wow. And I mean that in the best of ways, but wow.
Yeah, no, I feel you. Yeah. I could go on, but we only have 10 more minutes, and I want to get another poem in there. So, Victoria, are you really willing to read the one by Poetic Picasso?
Absolutely. All right, this is The Lady
didn't
Madeline.
Did the get in for this one?
No, I asked for it, but it didn't get loaded.
Oh,
There have been troubles with Frank's audios recently. I don't know. It didn't load.
Oh, okay.
Thanks, Beth.
All right, so this is The Lady Madeline by Poetic Picasso. Roderick Usher, the poor gent, that was my old friend, had presented himself to me as a hoary and fragile man seen, and his peculiar mien was that of a scared namby-pamby, for all the solitous terror in his dilated eyes was truly palpable. The house of Usher was towering and had a dark Gothic shade, covered by the menacing guise of the sable eyes of the raven. On the gable roof of dilapidated mansion nearby to the adjacent tarn, but it had a noticeable thin crack extended to the front of the house. The reflection of the moon had shone upon the obtenerated night as the sound of the flapping wings and croaks of ravens were audible, and the bracing wind thus blew the eerie echoes of the howling or the damp and dank moat erected on the top of a steep rock. I could hear the dreaded gnawing of the horrid rats with their beady eyes as they had gnawed at the fading wood of the walls and a visible erosion, and the sturdy planks of the floors would creak upon every step taken. But an unknown weeping and breathing had resonated behind the creepy walls. Flashing lightning and roaring thunder had increased by the passing minutes. The roaric dewdrops of rain fell upon the slippery roof and glass windows. The hour of the vintage clock had rung in the parlor below the rust. I had sensed the presence of an unbidden visitor. And that was no stranger. Suddenly, I'd heard the scream of a woman and the gasping of Roderick as I had dashed from my chamber to find him completely decomposed, for his terrifying eyes were evidently bulging with heightened trepidation, and it seemed he'd had witnessed an unthinkable ghost in person. Will she not be here, Anon? Is she not hurrying to upbraid me for my haste? Have I not heard her footsteps on the stairs? Do I not distinguish that heavy and horrible beating of her heart? Madman, 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 I tell you, that she now stands without the door. Who, I asked. The Lady Madeline, behold. End poem.
Thank you, Victoria. I love the enthusiasm that you put in the madman part. And it's so great to have you read with such feeling, because I know that his audio definitely had that expression. He said that he was recently on stage doing Poe recitations for high school, and I can imagine, because he's very theatrical, that would have been great. So thank you for putting some theatrics into the read. I really enjoyed this. I liked when he was talking about, well, to say that I liked it is a little bit deceptive, because it creeps me out, but that's a good thing in the Halloween, right, is the gnawing of the rats on the walls. And for it to be so bad that there's visible erosion, like that shows that there's a lot of chewing through the walls. And the sturdy planks of the floors now creak with every step. So, like, the wood is falling apart. The house is just hollowed out by these rats. And even though it's about the sound, he knows that they have beady eyes. You're not seeing the beady eyes. He's hearing it and imagining the beady eyes. And somehow that makes it worse. That part with the rats just really stuck with me. I think he brought that to life. Pam, what did you think?
Well, I like this. I like that he was inspired by one of my favorite Edgar Allan Poe stories, The Fall of the House of Usher. I have to say, you know, I really appreciate Frank and his writing. I'm a little hard-pressed to see the connection between this write and your topic, but that's okay. It was still worth hearing. Victoria did a wonderful read. I like how he brings us into that dark, visceral imagery, like the horrid rats, the beady eyes, and then the intensity at the end when a person's mind snaps. So, excellent write and very well done.
Yeah, that's true, Pam. I did not really want the seven deadly sins, and I do find when I open up my contest to pre-writes, I get a lot of that where it's not quite fitting, which is why I rarely do pre-write contests, but, you know, still a good Halloween kind of feel. And seems like we're just about out of time, so I'm just going to mention that we do have Double Helix coming up this Thursday, and my contest for that is Legacy. So it's about what it is to leave a legacy. The quotes that are prompts are, "The goal isn't to live forever, it is to create something that will," by Chuck Palahniuk. "Carve your name in on hearts, not tombstones. A legacy is etched into the minds of others and the stories they share about you," Shannon L. Elder. "And if you would not be forgotten as soon as you are dead, either write something worth reading or do something worth writing," Benjamin Franklin. So if any of those quotes inspire you, please write for my contest with the Duke of St. Paul, Dex Bailey, for Double Helix. And we are going to have a couple of carryovers from tonight, but please do keep an eye on my contest, Aphasiana, on allpoetry.com, because I will have another contest up this weekend for next Part Sinner, Part Saint. Thank you so much to both Pam and Victoria for calling in and, you know, commenting and sharing your insights and reading with me. I absolutely love having both of you on the show. Thank you to everybody who wrote for the contest, and thank you to Kel for calling in earlier, and thank you to Phil for giving us this show. So thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful Halloween weekend. Stay safe. Good night.
Good night.